This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. You can't cover the American economy without, in one way or another, having in the back of your mind the American dream. Whether it's rags to riches or just doing better than your parents did, upward mobility is part of the economic DNA in this country, even as it's debatable right now how real, how achievable the American dream actually is. Economists at Harvard and Berkeley have been trying to figure that out. And it turns out the answer varies widely depending on where you're from. Their theory, the economists at Harvard and Berkeley, is that by looking at places that have really bad rates of upward mobility, what things those places have in common and what they are missing in their fabric, maybe we can learn a thing or two. And that is what sent Chrissy Clark from our Wealth and Poverty Desk on a trip out to Dayton, Ohio.
In Dayton, 40% of children born poor stay poor, and just 5% make it into the top fifth of earners by the time they're adults. I'll get to some of the things that may drive those statistics in a moment. But first, it's worth pointing out that Dayton used to have a very different reputation. For most of the early 20th century, Dayton was known for innovation, opportunity, and upward mobility, full of people from humble backgrounds who made it. Like, say, the Wright brothers, who invented the airplane, or their high school classmate, Paul Lawrence Dunbar.
I know what the caged bird feels, alas.
Dunbar was born in Dayton in 1872 to parents who'd been born into slavery.
I know why the caged bird beats his wing till its
blood is red. This is a reading of one of his poems called Sympathy.
For he must fly back to his perch and cling.
When he wrote it, he was just out of high school, too poor to afford college, and working as an elevator operator. To support his poetry, he sold copies of his poems for a dollar to people who rode on his elevator. But just a decade later, he had catapulted himself into a different life.
He was the first African-American poet to become internationally famous. He met with the Queen of England. He met with Teddy Roosevelt.
Alex Heckman with the Dayton History Museum says Dunbar was a major inspiration for poets throughout the 20th century, like Maya Angelou. Maybe you recognize echoes of Dunbar's voice in her poem Caged Bird. And here in Dayton, Dunbar could turn all that literary success into economic success, too, as Heckman showed me.
We're looking at the Italianate-style two-story brick home of Paul Lawrence Dunbar. He really wanted to purchase the finest home that he could afford. It was a lovely middle-class neighborhood when he was living here.
Paul Lawrence Dunbar's house is now a historic landmark on what's now called Paul Lawrence Dunbar Street. Alex Heckman's organization gives tours of the home to the public, but the neighborhood around the house has changed a lot since Dunbar's time. What was once a lovely middle-class neighborhood is now a place Alex worries about bringing visitors. A warning, the next few seconds get a little graphic.
We've had violent felonies take place either on or immediately adjacent to the house itself. There was a homicide victim. Body was dumped and set on fire literally feet from the visitor center entrance.
A few doors down, a young man was shot.
We heard two rounds fired and then three more rounds shortly thereafter. The last, you know, half century of disinvestment in neighborhoods like this one, it's tragic.
So how does a place that celebrates a man who so famously achieved the proverbial American dream become a place so full of nightmares? That is, of course, not something a few minutes of radio can even begin to fully answer. But the fact that this neighborhood and many others like it in cities across the country have become so disinvested, so economically isolated, so full of concentrated poverty and the problems that come with it— that fact in itself has become a key part of Harvard economist Nathan Hendren's research on upward mobility.
Areas where there's more concentrated poverty, more economic segregation, tend to have lower rates of upward mobility.
Nathan Hendren's team has combed through decades of IRS data to track the earnings of kids born into poor families once they reach adulthood. They wanted to know which places have the best rates of upward mobility, which have the worst, and why. They've looked at all kinds of possible factors.
Like the quality of the labor market.
And
tax policies.
And
mean incomes in the areas, income growth, measures of immigration, the number of bowling alleys per capita.
What did you just say?
Yeah, so if you look at the number of bowling alleys, you actually see quite a positive relationship between the fraction of kids that are rising up out of poverty.
The theory there being that bowling alleys might be a sign of broader community engagement. But among all these different factors Nathan and his research team looked at, a few patterns rose to the top. One of the clearest in cities and towns across the country was that areas with lots of economic segregation and concentrated poverty do much worse when it comes to mobility.
The extent to which the poor at the bottom of the income distribution are geographically segregated from the middle class and the upper class. So it's really about, are people from disadvantaged backgrounds economically integrated into the local area?
In other words, a crucial part of economic mobility seems to be whether rich and poor and middle-class people are bumping into each other and interacting on a daily basis. The answer to that question in Dayton over the past couple decades has been a distinct...
No, not at all.
Kathleen Somerset Fields grew up in a public housing project not far from Paul Laurence Dunbar's home, long after he died, once it was in a neighborhood known for concentrated poverty and extreme racial segregation. The area's known as Dayton's West Side. Kathleen says stereotypes about West Dayton are so ingrained that in job interviews, she tries to avoid saying that's where she grew up.
You know, when you put that down on your resume and stuff, it's like, oh, the West Side of Dayton, here we go. I don't want to be looked at like that. I'm not the West.
But there's stereotypes that still come to mind that people have.
Yes.
Yeah.
Growing up, Kathleen faced an overwhelming tangle of struggles. Her mom and stepdad battled with drug addiction. Kathleen and her siblings were moved into foster care for a time. At 13, she had her first child and was basically the mother to her six younger siblings, paying bills, managing the food stamps and government assistance they survived on.
It was hard, but I'm grateful for it.
Why?
Because... I'm sorry. I don't know, I would say it empowered me. It really did, and stuff, to strive for better, to want better, to do better.
And she did. Somehow, unlike most of the kids she grew up with, Kathleen beat those overwhelming odds working against those born into poor families in Dayton and places like it. Today, she is the assistant manager of a youth program at a community center. She says she's definitely not rich, but...
I consider myself surviving. Is that a category?
I think,
can we make that one?
I think we can make it one.
Surviving on the good end.
Of course, it's impossible to say exactly why Kathleen found a way to climb out of poverty when so many of her peers have not. When I asked her what she thinks, she immediately pointed to one thing. Actually, to one person.
My boss now, Diane Brogan Adams, she was my teacher back then.
Her teacher in a GED class she took when she was 16.
And every time I would fall off, for some reason that lady always came and got me. Like, she would wonder, where am I at? Kathleen, hey, we haven't seen you for a while. You know, let's go ahead and get you through this class. You're almost there. And I graduated.
More on how crucial that education and those sorts of relationships can be, and why researchers think they might be key ingredients for economic mobility tomorrow. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.